This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics episode number 2 was recorded on July 24th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This is an unusual situation that came up for us at Macro Voices when we recorded Pippa Malmgren's most recent All-Stars interview. Her dad, Dr. Harold Malmgren, was visiting. He happened to walk into the room at the end of our session, and before we knew it, we were into what turned out to be a fantastic feature-length interview. It's a full-length interview, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating. We had to scratch our heads figuring out what to do with this one because our Thursday night flagship podcast schedule is booked out solid through Labor Day. We were afraid that we were going to have to put this one on the shelf. But I can't thank our sponsor, TopTradersUnplugged.com, enough. They heard that there was more Pippa on deck that was about to be put on the shelf and said, no way, if it's Pippa, we'll sponsor it. So I really want to thank TopTradersUnplugged.com for sponsoring this extra episode, which we're airing for you as a Sunday special. So I really hope that you enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed recording it. Let's go now to both Dr. Pippa Malmgren and her dad, Dr. Harold Malmgren. I'm joined today not just by our favorite geopolitical analyst, Dr. Pippa Malmgren, but also Dr. Harold Malmgren, advisor to, I believe it was 4 different U.S. presidents during his career. And I've just got to start, guys, with a personal interest question. You know, most of us have grown up in kind of average American households. I have to wonder, what is it like to grow up in a household where your father is an advisor to the President of the United States? Pippa, and I've got to believe that you were probably hit with a little bit more political conversation than most of the other kids in your class around the house. And then to grow up to become a presidential advisor yourself, I've got to believe that while most American families are talking about Kardashians and what's on the latest episode of The Simpsons and what Taylor Swift's latest adventures are, there's probably a little bit more political discussion in the Malmgren household. So tell us a little bit about life as a Malmgren. What's it like?
Well, you know, you're right. And what I loved growing up was my dad always took the time to explain to me the stories of what he was working on. And he said to me always, there's the front page of the Washington Post story, and then there's what's actually going on. And if you're going to work in Washington, you need to know what is actually going on. And the gap between the two can be like ridiculously wide. And I really learned that when you work in the White House and then you read the public reporting of what's going on and you're like, where did they even get this? It's so far off where reality is. So, yeah, and I'm very grateful. I had that. It's like an apprenticeship as a child in how to think about the world. And I remember one time there was a diplomat, a very prominent diplomat, who said to me, well, Pippa, so what part of the world are you going to specialize in? And I said, well, I don't really want to. I like looking at the whole picture. And he said, well, you can't do that. You have to choose, you know, India or the Middle East or Japan or China. And I remember going back to my dad and saying, do I really have to choose? Because I don't want to choose. And my dad said, well, the President of the United States doesn't have any choice. That person has to think about the global picture. And frankly, every chief executive has to think about the whole picture. So stick with that, kid. And I'm grateful for that advice. It worked.
Well, having Pippa as a daughter was challenging because she's really, she's really smart. And she's also quick with her tongue. So if you say something a little bit silly, she will react to it by straightening out what you're trying to say. But it became an adventure. And if I had anything to teach her, it was that politics is like a sports event. There are a lot of rivalries, some of them personal, some of them teams. And there are winners and losers in how the game is played. And it becomes interesting when you look at it that way. It's not analytical in the sense of a college course, but rather how is the game played? What are the rules? And who bends the rules and how do they get away with it? So it's always about the backstory. And the most clever politicians I've known over the years have been people who were very good at hiding what they were really doing so they could compromise with all the opponents on something without getting into a battle of ideological battle with their own party members. So there's always a now you see it, now you don't element. And it's usually the most important part of how leaders govern.
A question that I'm dying to ask you, Hal, I think all of us cherish the moments in our lives of accomplishment and achievement. I certainly remember selling my software company at the age of 33 and making enough money to retire and feeling like, wow, I've really done something I'm proud of here. In your career, you've had the experience of being an advisor to the president of the United States. When the president needs to know what to do, you're the guy who gets called into the room. You've had that experience. You know what that feels like. But you've also had the experience as a father of watching your daughter become an advisor to a different president of the United States. Which was a more rewarding experience, or how would you contrast those two experiences?
Oh, a period of my life was excitement and adventure, but watching Pippa, it's more a pleasure of having done something productive that goes beyond my life. So it's a different feel. It's enjoying at a distance the kinds of things I had become familiar with, but seeing it in someone else developing and becoming so agile in how things work and manipulating events. So it's a different experience. When you're in the heat of battle and you're trying to survive and keep your head, you keep getting shot. When somebody else is doing it and you're there in the background, there's a lot of pleasure in seeing that what you have been doing somehow passed on. Somebody else has picked up the ball and you know, you're older, you're not as good a sports athlete as you were, but this one is really something to watch.
And I have to say also, it's not only that my dad advised, you know, Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon and Ford, but he's advised so many heads of state across the world, like every Japanese prime minister, barring two or three of them since about 1972, many of the European heads of government over all those years. And so talking to him about an issue, he's always like, ah, well, remember that, you know, in Germany, this issue that you're raising started in, you know, in 1958 when, and then he'll give me the backstory and who was involved. And similarly, because I'm traveling the world pretty fast and hard these days, and I can bring home the stories of what I'm hearing. And we just have this wonderful ability to riff, and he gives me context and helps me see a pattern that's bigger than my own life experience permitted me to see.
Well, it's absolutely a delight for me to have the opportunity to interview both of you together, but we will have an audience revolt if we don't get into some business and economics issues. So let's talk about the biggest picture issue. You know, I think the highest level debate in finance these days is there are some people that think we're headed for outright crisis. There are also views that are maybe variants on that. Ray Dalio has said, hey, we're headed for a paradigm shift where central banks' ability to prop up asset markets is going to stop working and it's going to change a lot of things in a big way. Watch out. But there are other people who are saying, look, you know, it's time to stop denying what is now clearly proven fact, which is this policy that Ben Bernanke pioneered, to a lot of people's amazement, actually worked. And they really did rescue the global economy. And it's all uphill from here. There's lots of reasons to be bullish about the economy, the stock market, and everything else. Are these kinds of things, do you typically agree on these, or do you have some family disagreement?
Yeah, actually, we disagree quite a bit. We found that we can get into arguments about, yeah, because I will bring up, you know, all the bubbles in the economy, and when one bubble bursts, then we're going to have another. The argument that the financial markets are highly leveraged, even more than they were at the time of the Lehman shock in 2008. So many tripwires that it's inevitable we have some kind of financial crash. Pippa will have a different view because she's expecting that no matter how the financial market's working right now, there's nowhere else to go. So the investment will keep being poured into financialization and financial engineering, and it'll go much longer than one would expect. So we differ on this, and we can get in a short argument, but actually what preoccupies me now is a deeper question. Since World War II, the driver of growth throughout the world for most countries was world trade. Many countries, more than 100 countries, didn't have sufficient income and domestic wealth to grow except maybe at 1% or 2%. But by getting on the express train of exports, they could rely on demand in other countries. And so we had trade-powered growth. Most years for 50 years grew about half again or even twice as fast as national production. Now I think, a paradigm shift. We have reached the point where we can see in the data that air freight and sea freight, land-based trucking are all in decline. And a lot of people are thinking, that's a temporary thing. But then we can also see new orders for manufacturing are shrinking. It's most visible in Germany, but it was there in the figures from South Korea, which makes a lot of the same kind of stuff that Germany does. And part of it's related to China going through a period of adjustment. But boiled down, I see something secular here. I think that most of the physical stuff that you put in boxes, containers, and send somewhere doesn't make sense to keep doing that when you can send digital instructions somewhere else. And 3D printing and a computer, multi-purpose computer programmable devices can make the stuff right next door to the customer. So I think we are now headed towards localization and a secular decline in everything physical and shipping except for food. Food has to be shipped because there's not enough arable land in some places, not enough water. But think of what that means. It means like we got too many ships out there and we're going to probably melt a lot of them down. That physiology changes the game worldwide. The drivers will be personal services, will be financial services. It may be digital empires that go around crypto coin, but it's not going to be about Trump world trying to figure out how to get more jobs in Detroit. We're not going to get that. Also, there's one thing that is overlooked, and that is the engine, the primary engine in the world of trade has been Germany. Germany was able to grow by having half its GDP generated by external demand. But that's petering out. China copied everything Germany sold, and now they're competing with Germany and all the rest of the markets, and basically they will squeeze Germany out. So Germany, without trade, what does it have? It has bad demographics, it has bad taxes, rising costs of social overhead as people age, and German industry is already quietly, without talking about it, publicly thinking it's time to hollow out, just like the Americans did in the 70s. Maybe we have to hollow out. So the big three automakers in Germany are all thinking about increasing their production in Alabama and Georgia. And why? Because they see that as a good export platform to the world in a market that is basically shrinking because of a lot of reasons, including young people don't want to buy cars anymore. They don't want to take Uber or Lyft. So I see a big transformation going on behind all these fears of financial crash.
So, and I'm in a different place in the sense that I see this transition from a world where we measure the health of the world economy based on how many boxes are on a ship that moves from China to the United States, to a world where we send those instructions digitally, we manufacture locally. You know, again, I'm in this space. I 3D print the robotics that we sell to major corporations. We can literally 3D print something in our office in a matter of, you know, minutes. And so I don't have to wait for a product that's shipped from China to Britain anymore. And I see this transition happening so fast that the destruction of the old economy that depended on all those things is being overtaken by the creation of a new digital economy that is going to be worth more. But a lot of the components of it are, they're so fast moving, to be honest. This is such a feature of the modern world economy, is the speed of the change and how quickly things become possible that you thought were impossible. Actually, Dad, you mentioned, for example, food production. I'm really impressed by digital food production now, where you can literally grow lettuce and tomatoes and strawberries inside apartment buildings and office buildings using what they call fogponics, meaning you don't even put water on it. It's just fog. It's just mist. And you use virtually no electricity, mainly solar paneled energy to do it. And you're growing produce faster than in the real environment, but with higher nutritional content and better flavor as well. So basically you win on all fronts. And you can do this in anywhere. You can do it in the middle of the desert. You can do it in the middle of an urban area. And so suddenly the need to move things from A to B isn't what it was. And for all those who are really interested in climate change, this is a really good event. This is a world where we won't rely on global transportation and its energy costs in the way that we used to. But how the heck do you measure this new economy? Like, what is the marker? You remember, we both worked with Alan Greenspan during our time in government. And, he was famous for saying, my best measure of the economy is I call up the biggest company in America that makes boxes. And I just asked them, how are the box sales going? And that was a brilliant measure in the 1970s. It was a brilliant measure even in the 80s. But now it's an irrelevant measure because nobody's moving stuff in boxes from A to B the way they were, where they were 3D printing it right in their office. And so what is the new measure? Should we be trying to measure how much 3D printing is going on? Should we be trying to measure how much data is moving from one country or one part of a city to another? Like, we haven't yet got the equivalent of Alan Greenspan's box count. And that's what's really required. And then the point where we're really having our discussion is, what is the speed of this transformation? I see it happening super fast, but that's because I'm in it. Dad sees it happening much more slowly in a more fragmented way because a lot of people haven't got a foothold on the new economy that's coming yet. And I'll finish with one example. I think I see a huge economy evolving around augmented reality and virtual reality. And in fact, I'm working now on the ability to deliver virtual reality across the net to explain things that I'm interested in using VR and AR. And most people are like, well, what does that even mean? They can't conceptualize what I mean. And I say, well, imagine like you're sitting in your office and you hold your mobile phone up, your smart device up, and suddenly you see your entire office is completely jammed with virtual objects that are advertisements, that are media stories. In other words, the Washington Post and Coca-Cola will be 1 foot in front of your face, really within your hand's reach. And it's there all the time. You just don't see it unless you put the augmented and virtual reality glasses on or you look at it through a mobile phone screen. But it's there. And that there's a whole economy that is being created about those virtual spaces that you occupy. And by the way, these vendors of Coca-Cola or whatever, they're going to know exactly which space to put that in because they know exactly where you go to the bathroom and when you're in the bathroom. Yeah. They know exactly when you're on the school run picking up the kids. They know exactly. They know when you've broken up with your boyfriend or your girlfriend. And this is because the data that we're all giving off tells them. So now imagine the economy around all of that. So really, it's a question of what's the speed at which the society makes the transition. And I guess I see it happening much faster Dad, you probably see it happening a little bit slower with more dislocations for people as they adjust. But I still think the direction is positive.
Well, the problem in the speed is decision makers, that is, government officials, bureaucrats, regulators, the people who manage the machinery, they don't work fast. And also, they don't learn fast. They tend to be, all of them, even politicians, creatures of habit. What worked in the last election? And the question that's going to come up for every leader is, this is really moving fast. How do I get ahead of the curve? How do I ride this wave like a Malibu young man, you know, trying to be a champion wave runner? I don't see political leadership developing anywhere in the world, anywhere. I mean, I know pretty much the portfolio of leaders in virtually all the countries. One way or another, I've had contact. I even know Putin from 20, 30 years ago. I don't see anybody agile thinking that kind of world. Now, it's not only AR and VR, but let's give another example. Moving food, Pippa just mentioned that. If you're in Singapore, where the heck do you get your food? Because the only place you can go is up. There's no space going out. So vertical farming is the new thing. Vertical farming is sweeping across the world for city planners. How do we get, as the young people come more to the cities, how do we feed them? And vertical farming is now moving very fast. Mm. So there are many things we haven't been envisaging, but think of leaders. I mean, how much of all of this does Trump know about? The answer is he's still trying to think how to restore jobs in Detroit for automakers when it's all changing. We're going to have much more localization, and the crises are going to be more actually micro. They're going to be local communities having trouble getting themselves organized. It's going to mean devolution of power from the centers to more and more people. And I don't think society is ready for that either, but that's how you're going to keep order.
Actually, Detroit is such a great example because for so many people in their mind, Detroit is the iconic image of failure. But the fact is today, Detroit is totally on fire. They cannot build five-star hotels fast enough in Detroit. They've got a manufacturing base there. They're manufacturing all kinds of things, not just cars anymore. It's become a retail center. It's back in the music business again. Music is a massive business these days as it's become digital. So, you know, our own understanding of what is reality. Is Detroit a basket case, or is it like you should be moving there because it's so happening? And the answer is it's both in people's minds. I know people who think one and people who believe the other. And you can find examples in Detroit of both happening. Maybe that's part of what's happening in the world economy. It is this split between who are the beneficiaries of the innovation and who's getting left behind. And this is the thing where I'm so very aware of my dad's personal background as the child of Swedish immigrants who came to the United States with nothing and were able to make the leap from, you know, getting off the boat to having a son in the White House in one generation. And I really do worry that our biggest problem is that we do not have sufficient avenues for young people to be able to make those leaps. And as a result, people lose faith and confidence in the machinery of government and the society that they live in, because it doesn't deliver to everybody. And we can talk about the reasons why. Is it income disparity? Is it lack of opportunity? There are many angles, but I think that is the biggest constraint on the economy, is the lack of belief that it could work for me.
So it turns out we don't disagree that much. It's just about the timing.
Yeah.
I think Pippa thinks that we've got quite a ways to go before the financial markets are overstretched. Whereas I can see all kinds of reasons why we're going to have crises in the corporate bond market that spill out into other parts of the financial market. The accident possibilities are tremendous. And wherever I look in the world, the number of leaders I can tabulate in my head who are capable to rise to the occasion, you know, now we're down to two or three maybe. Nobody's prepared for all this change. And nobody's running on a campaign of how do we take care of our next generations. Everybody's busy with issues of last year or last decade. So it's that problem of the mismatch between who governs us and what is happening that I think creates a real challenge. As Neil Howe would say, we're going through a fourth turning here, and it may be turbulent.
I want to come back to the bond market, particularly next generation, some great topics there. But first, I just want to mention for the benefit of any listeners who might have been a little bit thrown off by Pippa's description of this idea of AR, augmented reality. It was a great description, but it's still very hard to describe in words. I recommend that everyone do a web search on Microsoft HoloLens AR, three separate words, Microsoft Holo, like hologram, HOLOLENS, AR. I don't know if Microsoft is good, bad, or indifferent at this technology, but they're good at producing really cool videos that explain what the concept is. There's one by a guy called James Mackey that I just watched yesterday, which it really is amazing to see windows popping up in your living room in the middle of space next to your, you know, to your armchair or whatever. So I wanted to make that point, but I want to come back to this idea of localization because I have a question about trust as it relates to this. If we look at the way the electronics industry has worked for years now, you get your electronics, if you're a manufacturer, you outsource your actual manufacturing operations to China usually because it's very, very cost effective. But a very common practice is that the electronics get assembled and soldered together, but they never install the firmware. That's the actual programming that runs those little chips on the electronic device until after the product is shipped from the factory to whoever the U.S. company is that's actually selling that product. And the reason is they don't trust the Chinese manufacturing outsource company not to, if they were contracted to make 1,000 of something, the fear is they're going to make 5,000 of them and sell 4,000 of them on the black market and compete with whoever their real customer is. So it makes me wonder about this idea of being able to use something like 3D printing. Pippa, you're in the drone business. If someone calls you from, let's say, Brazil and says, look, we've got a great application for your drones here. We want to buy 500 drones, but let's do this efficiently. Send us all your design files so that we can print the parts here. We'll put them together, and don't worry. We're going to count, and whatever a number that we actually build, we're going to send you a check for. Trust us. I got to believe that you wouldn't do it that way. So is there a safe way to do it where you can let that manufacturing occur locally but still protect your IP rights?
Well, I think there is. And that's exactly where we're intending to go with my firm, H-Robotics, where we can easily provide the CAD files that allow you to 3D print the case and even the props, the propellers. And we'll reach a point where you could even build the motors this way, and that's all fine. But the software that effectively acts as the brain that permits it to fly autonomously and to make sure that the data all ends up in the right place at the right time, we might ship that. We might not give away to the world, you know, how we do that part. But it means that we can be local everywhere and still retain our IP. And the other thing is, you know, you can also know what is happening to your software these days. It's not like the old days where, you know, if someone copied your hardware and software design, then you would just never know. These days, if somebody tries to take apart one of my drones, I will see that. I will actually be alerted. I will know. I will know exactly where it is. I will see the physical location. I can tell whether they're trying to whack it with a hammer, you know, to get inside. I can structure it so that even if you smash it to try to see what's inside, you'll destroy the interior in such a way that it won't be any use to you, right? It's a very different world from how parts manufacturing worked in the old days. So I actually think what's happened is the reverse has occurred. People think they have IP protection when they go to file patents. And in fact, patents have become the number one way that you get killed because you file them, you announce to the world exactly what you're doing, everybody copies it, And then good luck trying to take everybody to court. I mean, if you're a big company, you can do it, but it's a lot of resources. It's very expensive. So it forces all the manufacturers to go a different direction, which is to be smarter, faster, more agile. You basically have to run 2-3 years ahead of the market at all times. And that is your protection, is your speed.
There's something I'd have to add to this. Pip and I haven't talked about this directly, but it happens that my first assignment in Washington in the real life of politics was in the Pentagon. I worked for Bob McNamara, and I was catapulted into all kinds of discussions about new weapons. And since then, I followed that area pretty closely. So I can take the same kind of issue that she's discussing. We have something called the F-35 aircraft. Controversial, very expensive. What is it? Well, we allow other countries to make components. Actually, the production is done in many places. But what it's really all about is it's a flying brain. It's an integration system that, like the old surveillance aircraft, the AWACS that we had, the F-35 can look down and see air, land, sea, and even subsea, underwater, everything that's available, and can control all that firepower all at once. That's what the F-35 is all about. You only need one to do what 50 had to do before. Nobody understands it. It's a flying brain. Now, that when you put your mind into that context, everything changes. How would you fight? How would you respond to somebody? It's all about the software, and we don't disclose that. We let everybody participate in making these things, but we don't tell them how the software works. And we don't, for example, with Turkey, we're just saying to Erdogan, you can't have this thing because we'd have to tell you about the brain, and you can't have it if you've got Russian air defenses in your system, because they'll teach each other. So this is in areas that we really don't think about. It's a different world where processing of data becomes central to everything. And our military, increasingly, they don't think about fighting land warfare. They don't think about, they think it's unimaginable that we go out and kill a lot of our boys and girls. And nuclear war, it's unthinkable. I cannot imagine Russia, China, and the U.S. ever getting into armed conflict on any scale. But what we can envisage is 48-hour conflict, in which a lot of firepower is exchanged and somebody gets a bloody nose and backs off. But all of this is about this brain power that's flying on top of the wings. And the next generation in defense nobody's talking about is the F-35 is called fifth generation aircraft. Sixth generation is already well developed and on the way, and it's unmanned. It's autonomous transportation, with the purpose being to move the brain around, just like with a drone, to process what you can see and use it. Let me add one point. Ford Motors is now moving out of personal vehicle production. They're basically, apart from the Mustang, going to leave the car business. Where are they going? Well, the head of Ford Motors now was the head of autonomous vehicle development. They are basically thinking, how do we build autonomous trucks to move anything that needs to be moved without people? That's already well on the way. And you can see it in truck orders. Everybody stopped ordering new big trucks because they're expecting something totally different in the next few years.
You know, this extends even further. Like, imagine, we talk about the repo man, that if you fall behind in your car payments, then some guy shows up and takes your car. No, now your car is going to drive itself back to the company that you've leased it from. Maybe with you in it. You know what I mean? Like, this is the thing. Everything is driven by the brain. It's what we do with our drone company is exactly like the F-35. If we think someone is using it improperly, or we don't like, we think they're trying to get into it and rummage around, it can just be turned off. And that's exactly what we do with the F-35. We're like, you can buy it, but we'll decide whether you're flying it any given time. And that's a completely different mental construct for the world economy. And it takes me back to that question again, is what's the appropriate measure of real economic activity in a world where it's all about data, including, I totally agree with the assessment of warfare. You know, throughout history, we've had warfare that was driven by land power, warfare driven by sea power. We know the air power was the defining factor for the last two world wars. Today, we're in an era of data power, and wars will be fought using data. It'll be like the business of turning off the Iranians' nuclear capabilities, and they just don't even realize. But what's happened is somebody has changed the data parameters, and suddenly you can't produce the uranium anymore. In other words, James Bond today is not armed with a handgun or a grenade or even a fighter jet. James Bond today is armed with code, with a USB, with some kind of data management tool. And that's the world we're in.
It really is an amazing paradigm shift because, you know, back in the old days, the way electronics worked was the little screws that hold the device together have a little plastic sticker on top of them that says, warning, if you break this seal, you're voiding the warranty. Now, there's no little plastic sticker. It's you go ahead and you take your screwdriver, you start to unscrew the screw on your drone, and your phone beeps, and it's a text message, and it says, Pippa is watching you right now. She can see what you're doing. Don't turn that screwdriver. What it makes me think, though, is you think talk about the F-35. Obviously, they go to great lengths to protect the security of these things. But it seems to me that the scope of what hacking risk is completely, totally different than what it used to be. Because if you hacked the firmware on an F-16, you could have easily disabled its radar system or its autopilot system so it didn't work. But if you somehow could manage to hack an F-35, you could change it so as soon as it takes off, the pilot has no ability to do anything, and it attacks the tanker and sinks the tanker it just took off from. You know, if you could somehow control the code. So I, obviously, people are working hard to make sure that doesn't happen. But holy cow, the stakes have gone up, haven't they?
They have. And again, what's the definition of hacking? Because these days, I think most governments, they're not trying to hack into each other's systems in order to cause them to malfunction. They're trying to get in there so they can just listen to everything you're doing. It's a completely different objective. You know, industrial intelligence is being gathered. You don't want to disrupt the other guy's systems. You want him to think there's absolutely no problem. And then you just listen to everything. You just gather all the data. And by the way, what is the purpose and function of an Amazon and a Google? And they're just data gathering machines. And so they're not trying to disrupt your life and stop things from happening. They're trying to get your life to work as it normally would, fully understand it. And then there's tremendous power in knowing how people operate.
Let me add something that is current in all of our minds, this allegation or the accusation that China is stealing all our stuff. Ooh. And we've got to stop them stealing. And we send a bunch of negotiators to talk to the Chinese, and at first I was baffled. I mean, what are we going to ask them for? Scouts are a promise. We won't steal anymore. That's going to be meaningless. And gradually, what I concluded in talking to some companies that really guard their technology fiercely, I said that you've got to be able to shield your technology so that it's impenetrable. But that means much more advanced, much more complex cryptography. You're going to need next generation computer technology to do this. And the answer I've gotten each time I've said that is, oh, that's too expensive. We have to run a business like we would a retail shop. We have to allow a certain amount of shoplifting because otherwise it doesn't function. Well, the reality is you can't do that anymore. You really have to, if you have something precious, you have to shield it. And shielding is going to be bloody expensive. But the problem with that is it's a fixed cost. It doesn't generate profits. So most financial managers say, I don't want to do it if it's fixed cost and there's no profit. There's nothing for the bottom line. So right now, the only area in the U.S. economy that's at this advanced stage is the defense sector, where they have to shield everything. Yeah, otherwise, they'd be dysfunctional.
And in fact, this is one of the big new sectors of the world economy is the hackers who get into your systems and then they don't shut it down. They just want a payment for it.
Yep.
And all the big institutions, financial and otherwise, they're paying because the cost relative to having to deal with it is actually reasonable. And so this business of holding companies to ransom over their data is a whole sector of the economy now. It's incredible.
I want to come back to the family disagreement about where the economy is headed, because I know that makes good radio. But specifically, Hal brought this up with respect to the bond market. First of all, we've got $13 trillion of negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. And, you know, it's easy to explain the mechanics of how that happened. There are certain investors that by mandate have to use a safety trade into sovereign bonds, and whether it seems to make economic sense or not, that's what they're doing. Okay, fine. But if you step back and look at the absurdity of paying for the privilege of putting money at risk, and particularly something I think a lot about, and not many other people seem to be talking about, it creates, unless you outlaw cash, which hasn't happened yet, it creates a cash hoarding incentive that I think could lead at some point to a run on the entire fractional reserve banking system. So you've got that going on. Now in Europe, where you live, Pippa, or next door across the channel there, there are now 14 different European junk bond issues. So that's where the credit rating agencies say, look, don't invest in this unless you're getting paid a really, really high yield, because it's a company that we think is maybe going to default. And so you're taking a big risk here. People are buying those bonds when they are negative yielding junk bonds. And I mean, if you had said that 5 years ago, anyone who knew anything about finance would have laughed in your face and said, you obviously don't understand what a junk bond is or what a negative yield is, because that's impossible. But now we have it. It seems to me like when systems kind of go to extremes before things snap and pop and break and fall apart, there's usually examples like this. There's the old skyscraper index where, you know, just as they build the most ridiculously overdone skyscraper, it marks the top in the economy. How could negative yielding junk bonds and $13 trillion of negative yielding debt, Pippa, not support your dad's argument that maybe there's a problem here?
So first, let me just
listen to Hal in the background, just keep giggling.
First, I was just going to say, this will be my last question because my daughter is waiting for me to come help her make dinner, and we're doing dinner for grandpa tonight. But the second thing is, first of all, this is not the first time in history we've seen negative interest rates. And one thing we know about negative interest rates is nothing creates inflation more efficiently than a negative interest rate environment. And I stand by the view I've had for many years that we are fomenting inflation. It doesn't necessarily need to become runaway inflation or something that we can't control, but I think there's no question that everyone in the world is feeling the higher cost of living. And what's strange is the data doesn't quite affirm that that's true, but I think everyone knows that they're having to run harder to maintain the same standard of living, because costs have definitely risen in every possible category that matters to daily life. The second thing is, it's all about the incentives. And I remember when the bailout happened, the thing that concerned me most at the time was what we now call financial repression, which is basically to say to the banks and the financial institutions, if you're a regulator and you say, you need to be doing more safe things with the money. You should not be taking so much risk, because the last time you did that, it did not end well. And you say, yes, absolutely. And they say, well, we think you should put like a third of all your cash in bonds. And you say, well, actually, I think that's a pretty risky position. And they say, well, we think that you could be audited like 30 different ways tomorrow unless you agree to do this. There's an element of policymakers persuading, I'll use a gentle term, institutions to behave in a certain way because they think they're doing the right thing. And that's why I've argued for many, many years that the bond market is no longer a good measure or a good signaler of inflation risk. It isn't. people don't hold bonds because they don't believe inflation is coming. They hold them because they know they'll get in trouble with the regulators if they don't. So, and what do the regulators want? They want someone to hold the debt. And what have we seen in recent, like the last few years? China selling American treasuries like crazy. Who's buying them? Oh, the Saudis. The Saudis are now big buyers. You know, somebody, the pension funds in America become big buyers. And they argue, but this is a safe thing to do. And I say to the pension fund chief investment officers, but you are loading grandma up with a whole bunch of risks that could come unstuck in future. And they say, yes, Pippa, you know this, and I know this, but all my pensioners think that bonds are safe. And so, you know, it's a mindset. It's an assumption set about what does a bond represent. In theory, it's a safe instrument and you'll get paid back. In practice, we live in a world where there isn't enough money to pay everybody back. So the question is, something's got to give.
Well, yeah, if I can wind up the discussion, what Bernanke did was he took our debt structure and stretched it out by, in effect, expanding the debt level. So we had now a decade of growth that was debt-driven. We ended up with most of the growth was increased credit. We were borrowing from the future. We're at the point now where it's harder and harder to see how far into the future we can go. And that stretching of the system is going to, at some point, you can't go forever because you get to the point where the servicing of debt becomes bigger than your annual growth of the economy. And then you're in a trap. So we've got to rethink how to address debt. And I'm not sure the central banks really understand any of this. I think the central bank thinking is still mired in measurable numbers that come out of the regulatory system. You've done a brilliant job, Eric, with these podcasts with Jeff Snyder on the Eurodollar. It's amazing to me that there's so little understanding of the reality that the Eurodollar system is outside the reach of the Fed, outside the reach of the Bank of England. No central bank really controls it. It's built on leveraged borrowing and hyper-collateralization so that you get multiples of whatever is printed out there. It works fine as long as the markets are rising, but once the markets start falling, you have to sell all this stuff, and then there's not enough buyers around, and you get what we're beginning to see, so-called dollar shortage. You get a liquidity crisis. With that, you get a crash. That's where Pippa and I differ. I think we are vulnerable to a real crash because we just run out of liquidity. And then, you know, the difference between being liquid and not is insolvency. That's what happened to Lehman.
Hal, I want to come back to a comment you made earlier about future generations. You've had, I think, a very rewarding life. You've advised 4 U.S. presidents. Your daughter has been a presidential advisor. I know that you've done a wonderful job of preparing and providing for your family. But your granddaughter, who is now cooking dinner as we're finishing up this interview, a lot of experts are now saying that her generation will be the first in American history that will enjoy a lower standard of living than those that preceded it. This is the first time that Generation Z will be the first American generation that it's a lower standard of living than their grandparents lived. How do you feel about that? And what do you think the real culprits are and what needs to change in order to fix it, assuming you agree that it's a serious problem?
Oh, that's a big question, but I think about it quite a bit. I have 5 daughters altogether and 1 son. And the daughters I worried about more than as a father, you know, because they're coming into a different life when they move from girlhood to womanhood. And yeah, they're going to be at a time of life when it's not going to be, you know, the fruit's not going to fall off the tree and you have to do something. And I've thought about it quite a bit. My youngest daughter has now just graduated from Virginia Tech. And I said, what am I going to study? I said, study information technology. She said, I don't want to sit behind a computer screen. I said, no. But what you need to be able to do is understand that world and be able to get in front of a bunch of 50 and 60-year-old people who run everything and explain it to them and somehow bridge the two generations. She said, well, that's interesting. I said, believe me, there's going to be a shortage of that. But very few adults are thinking about this for their kids, and very few universities are thinking about this. But we are going through this major transformation, and our system is not looking at what will be needed. In every field, there's going to be that gap between the experts and the average people, and that can only be filled by people who understand both ends. So she did that, and I met a lot of her classmates, and it was interesting. Indians, Pakistanis, Ukrainians, Russians, Chinese, and she came out first in her class. And the dean said to me, how did you do that? I said, I just forced her to do this information technology to master it. And he said, yeah, but she's a babe. She also looked like a runway model. And I said, yeah, well, I was thinking if she gets in that position, everybody's going to watch. Women and men are like, you know, say, oh, wow, this is fun. But it's a way of grasping hold of what you're talking about. I fear that our systems are not geared to training young people in any useful direction. So, you know, I have a friend who builds pipelines for BP in Alaska. And he said, I can't find welders. And I said, gee, then the high school where my kids, my youngest kids went through, they had facilities to teach welding, but the kids don't go to it. So I said, where do you get your welders? They said, we get retirees who are master welders who are 60, 75, ready to get away from the wife for a few months, get high pay, drink a lot, and come back to the normal life. So he said, it's an easy catch to get retirees to be master welders and go to remote places. They have a ball. That's the world we're coming to, and nobody's ready for it, because the retirees will be gone. But this next generation, none of them have any skills, and they don't have an appreciation of what they need to know. All they know is instant response. They instant gratification, watch video games, that runs all the way through the mid-20s, even to the 30s nowadays. Instant gratification, I won, I lost, I beat the score. So how do we change that? Well, I don't know, because the teaching profession is really one of the slowest moving institutions in society to change anything. Universities don't adjust. They resist change. So I don't have a really good answer yet. It's a big worry in my mind, because we are leaving a lot of people with a bad period ahead where they're going to have to struggle. But the one thing about the U.S. that I can, looking back, I grew up in World War II, you know, the end of the Great Depression, and all the younger men went to war. But as a result of that, all the boys and girls who were 12 or 13 had to do adult things. And they all became, actually, later, ready for real work. So we had a generation from the 60s onwards of a vibrant economy with a lot of people in management who were 12 or 10 during the war. Because they faced adversity, had to go do something, and they learned how to tackle any challenge, and they didn't think, who's older than I am? They thought, I got to do this. Mom needs me to do it. So maybe it's we will have something come out of all this adversity that I can see coming, a resilient rebound. I've had discussions with Neil Howe about this. He's optimistic. I'm a little bit gloomy because I don't see education adapting. But so, it's a big question.
I think, yeah, I see this really very, very differently from you, Dad. Because, for example, I remember learning to play Minecraft with your granddaughter, my daughter Penny, when she was younger, because I wanted to understand. All the kids were playing Minecraft. So I thought, okay, what is this thing? And it's so easy to kind of dismiss it as, you know, it's a game, it's a video game. But you know what? It was the best 3D puzzle that I ever found. And you know, I love puzzles. But it taught you incredible skills and made you agile at managing in a data world. And I love, you know, the guy who's written Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker, who's probably one of the leading scriptwriters of our generation now. Charlie Brooker did a fantastic documentary on the history of video games. And when you listen to this documentary, you realize how much societal and personal human learning has happened in the game environment that's now translated into the real economy in other ways. And I see this in my robotics business. We make things that are based on the assumption that the operator is familiar with games and therefore will know how to manipulate to get the data outcome that they want. But the other thing is, you know, you say, whether is this generation going to face a lower standard of living? My answer to that is they're going to redefine what a standard of living is. Yeah. And our definition, you know, and, you know, I'm now in my 50s. Our generation, the definition was you own your own house and you retire by the time you're, I don't know, 55. And you have a certain kind of car and a certain number of vacations every year. These younger generations are like, you know, actually owning your own house isn't the be all end all. There are other better savings mechanisms potentially. Let's face it, house prices have not been the most reliable thing on the planet. They're investing much more in themselves. And here's another point of differentiation between my dad's view and mine. I'm actually not worried about the fact that conventional education is not delivering, because all these young people have something that is outside that called the internet. And the internet lets you learn in incredible depth and at every possible level without needing a teacher. It's like the Great Reformation, right? You don't have to go to the Catholic Church to pray to God. You can actually just have that conversation directly yourself. It's a reformation where people are going, I don't need a university to teach me stuff. I can learn by myself. And I think that we have not fully understood the magnitude of the learning that's happening in this unconventional way. Of course, it's happening in a very independent way, and it's making humanity more atomized, more individualistic, less willing or able to work together in groups, arguably. And so there's some societal downsides. But are we getting people that are more prepared for the future? You know, I think people are more into lifelong education. It's not anymore about go to college and you're done. And maybe this is a great thing that we're redefining what is a good standard of living. And young people who say, you know, part of my time should be for just hanging out with my friends doing absolutely nothing. And I remember that feeling as a kid. And frankly, I hanker for that now as an adult. I value that. And I love that Einstein always said that creativity is the residue of time wasted. In fact, what's really not good is this view that we've created that you must be working very hard all the time from the moment you get up in the morning to the moment you go to bed, and you'll never get ahead any other way. No, that's not the world we have to live in now. And you can make a decent living without having to kill yourself, arguably. And we should take advantage of this and redefine that a good standard of living gives you that space. The space to live, space to be creative, space to not have to be on your game 100% of the time. Anyway, very different ways of conceptualizing about what's the definition of a good standard of living.
Well, I can say simply that just listening to Pippa now, that's an example where at least I contributed something by encouraging her to think big, to think beyond all the rules, think behind what you see. Don't get caught up in the spin of the narrative that you're supposed to learn. And out pops this very creative mind, which thinks outside all the normal barriers. And so that for me is it's very satisfying that I did something right.
Aww. Well, you certainly did. And I can't thank both of you enough for a fantastic interview. Before I let you go, though, please tell our listeners where they can follow both of your work. Hal, you're definitely still kicking, writing, doing some interesting things. For people who want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle and what else should they know about what you're up to these days?
Twitter was something I fell into because Pippa, I was going through a bout of cancer that was pretty severe. And my brain was firing at all cylinders, but I didn't have strength. So Pippa said, why don't you play with Twitter? So I never promoted anything I did. I was just out there putting ideas here and there. And it's become an engine of connection between me and a lot of other smart people around the world. It's an amazing, in Twitter there's rant and frustrations and anger, but there's also a lot of smart people who don't have time for big papers, but they can read a very concise point and respond to it. I met amazing number of really bright people this way, and I gradually, when I'm going around the world, I interconnect with them personally. And this week in London, I'll meet at least three people I've never met before who are running think tanks or doing something imaginative. But the Twitter handle is, my nickname when I was a boy was Hal, H-A-L. And so I just call it Hal's Rethink. It's all about rethinking everything you see, and there's another story behind it. And that's it, just at Hal's Rethink.
And yeah. I'm trying to get my dad to write a book, and maybe you can help me with this and encouraging him to just, we got to write a book.
You know, I think there's room to work here because there's something Hal knows. I need him to influence someone we know on another subject. So maybe we can broker a deal, but we'll talk about that off the air. What's your handle for everyone's benefit?
Yeah, I do Twitter and Instagram. I've trained myself to operate without words on Instagram, and it's been great fun learning how to do it. I'm under Dr. Pippa M, DrPippaM. I would have just put Pippa M because nobody can pronounce Malmgren except the Swedes because there aren't enough vowels in it. But I realized if you put Pippa M, you get the sister of the future Queen of England, mainly photos of her rear end. And that wasn't what I was after. So I had to put the doctor in front. But again, I love social media too. I've been a little less involved with it lately because I'm so busy building a robotics company. But I like to put up there things that I think are really worth considering. And there is a lot of thoughtful consideration that happens on social media these days once you take the noise out. Yeah.
Well, let's put the call out that everyone who wants to read a book written by Dr. Harald Malmgren will just tweet their support to @HalsRethink. And see if we can get a little bit of viral energy going. Well, Pippa and Hal, I cannot thank you both enough for a fantastic interview. We really look forward to having both of you back on Macro Voices in the future for more updates. Again, today's episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. If you want a different perspective on how to invest in today's markets without emotions or predictions, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro, where you can claim a free book about a highly dependable and consistent, yet frequently overlooked investment strategy. I really want to personally thank Top Traders Unplugged for stepping up and sponsoring this extra episode. It was their sponsorship that allowed us to bring it to you now, as opposed to having to wait a couple of months or so. So thanks again to Top Traders Unplugged. And for the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. Have a great weekend, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.